Welcome back to Shep Talks. This summer, Shep hosted several events with innovative and dynamic leaders doing anti-poverty work. For this episode, we will listen in on a talk Shep's director, Tim Diet, had with Bo King, a federal public defender and the chief of the Fourth Circuit Capital Habeas Unit. Bo previously worked for the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama and Atlanta Legal Aid Society, and talks about how he saw both poverty and place play a role in his work.
So welcome to the first of four Practitioner Insight events this summer, all part of our 2022 summer internship program. My name is Tim Diet. I'm the executive director of the Shepherd Higher Education Consortium on Poverty, or SHEP. Thank you all for joining us this evening. We're in for a real treat. We are joined tonight by Bo King. Hi, Bo.
Hi there.
From the Fourth Circuit of Capital Habeas Unit. Now, thank you for taking the time out. Maybe we could start by you explaining to me what I just said. So I'll admit, I don't know exactly what that means.
Sure. So I'm the chief of the Capital Habeas Unit for the Fourth Circuit. So we represent death sentence prisoners within the appellate jurisdiction of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in federal habeas proceedings and then subsequent proceedings like executive clemency, competency, method of execution challenges. So the Fourth Circuit is Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, West Virginia. So the majority of our work is in North and South Carolina, which are the only two states in that jurisdiction with really active state death sentencing.
All right. Well, thank you. Yes, I should have mentioned in the comments that we are recording this evening. Should have also mentioned to everyone that the format, I'm going to start off asking Bo a few questions, but hang in there, and then we'll ask you to sort of use the raised hand function later. You can turn your video on, and you'll be able to ask Bo some questions. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, your path to that, your current role.
Sure. Well, I've done capital defense for the bulk of my career. So I, to my, you know, enduring shame, went to Duke University undergraduate. Tim has already given me a good roasting on this. So,
true. The blurred background. I got my UNC cup. Yeah.
We're going to do a slow roasting. Yeah. I initially thought that I wanted to be an English professor and worked in the English department there for a little while. Decided that was a bad idea. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Uzbekistan for about 2.5 years, working as an English teacher and encountering sort of the first wave of Central Asian refugee resettlement because of where I was in the country. I came back and went to law school and became kind of radicalized capital punishment. I was at NYU and I had the good fortune to study with Brian Stevenson and Randy Hertz. And then I ended up going to work with Brian down in Alabama at the Equal Justice Initiative for about 3 years. Then I went to a Halloween party in Atlanta and I met my wife. So I decided I needed to move to Atlanta. So I did a brief stint with the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. I did some employee side employment discrimination work for a little while. And then I sort of returned to capital work. I spent about 13 years working in the Capital Habeas Unit for the Northern District of Georgia. So we represented the great majority of death sentence prisoners in Georgia. And then in late 2020, I accepted this job, which was to start the first regional capital habeas unit in the country, the first one, you know, not confined to a single district, federal district court, but covering, you know, several states. So we've been building that office over the next, over the last year and a half. I'm actually appearing in a hotel room in Raleigh where I connect the Wi-Fi to work, which is why I'm on my phone, why my hands look enormous. And I was where I spent most of the day on the North Carolina death row at Central Prison, just a few blocks from here. So quick overview of path.
Yeah. Well, and you know, our theme for the summer is poverty in place, and you've certainly served in a lot of different locations. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how place, as well as sort of, you know, the intersection of, you know, of class, of income, of race, and ethnicity and, you know, and gender, if how any of those things have you seen sort of play out in your work?
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, I'll start with the death penalty since it's been the bulk of my professional career. The death penalty is the product of poverty. Death sentences depend enormously on the lack of funding for indigent defendants facing death sentences or the imposition of death sentences. And states that put resources into capital defense, to having sort of skilled and funded capital defense offices, have very few death sentences. They're really intertwined. Poverty is also a through line and probably the most consistent trauma that appears in the lives of all of my clients. And almost without exception, my clients grew up battling and really defeated by poverty. And I'm going to be out of my depth relative to the folks in this Zoom, I know, but I remember reading David Shipley's book, The Working Poor, years ago. And in the opening chapter, he talks about how the defining characteristic of that specific type of poverty is just vulnerability. You know, that things that are an inconvenience for people with resources are fatal for someone who, you know, if they have car trouble, you know, they lose their job. If they lose their job, they lose their health insurance. If they lose their health insurance, they can't survive a survivable illness or injury. And with my clients, you know, we see again and again the story that the most common theme that we encounter in the lives of our clients are these moments where, you know, the client is experiencing physical abuse or sexual abuse or neglect. The client has suffered a brain injury. The client is suffering lead poisoning effects, itself a very direct consequence of poverty. And there are people who notice sometimes who are like, this student is falling behind. This student who was formerly cheerful seems withdrawn. Or it's like, hey, this kid in the neighborhood has strange bruises. But there is no, there's none of the social structure that folks who are not impoverished can rely upon to rescue that child. And so we, that is to me the, I think I said at the beginning, I mean, I consider the death penalty kind of the product of poverty. And I really believe that to be true, both in the sense that most of our clients have just been horribly damaged by poverty in their lives prior to the offense for which they were sentenced to death. And then the quality of representation that they receive is defined entirely by the will of the jurisdiction to provide resources for the defense of an indigent prisoner. And in the majority of places where I've worked, those that will is waning and weak.
Yeah. So in the, you know, the many years you've been practicing this, have you seen, you know, sort of trends either, you know, are there any areas that there are things have been getting any better?
Sure. Georgia is actually a good example where Georgia did a few years ago create a capital defender office, and they hired lawyers with experience in capital trials. They provided them with the resources to conduct investigations into their clients' social histories and the resources to get mental health evaluations and other expert assistance. And Georgia, as a result, went through many years with no death sentences. The majority of the cases ended before trial with some kind of a resolution. And those that did go to trial resulted in the jury saying, this client is not, and I'm paraphrasing loosely the standard, this client is not the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. This client is not among this narrow slice of the most culpable for whom we theoretically reserve death sentences. And that, and so of course, there has been ongoing efforts, and unfortunately they've been more successful in recent years to snuff out that office because of its success mm-hmm. in providing representation to indigent defendants. So, I mean, I think that there have been these moments of progress, but in, I mean, what feels like kind of the story of the country in a lot of ways, we have these moments of progress and then a very quick backlash. But there's some very good work being done by organizations, I mean, sort of extra legal work by organizations like the Equal Justice Initiative, where I work, to really shine a light on the, really a huge part, I think, of EGI's work is shining a light on poverty and the effects of poverty on the country, how it really just sort of remains kind of a disease in the country that, you know, damages people and then causes all of this sort of extended relating kind of cascading damage.
Fascinating. Curious about in your work, who are the other partner, or maybe they're not partners, maybe they're adversaries, but who are the sort of the key other folks, like within a given community you go into, you know, you take up a case and work with a client, who are some of the other folks that you're going to, you know, work with?
There are other offices. I mean, there are other offices in within the Fourth Circuit that provide capital representation at earlier stages, and we work closely with them. They do terrific work. There's an organization in Columbia, South Carolina called Justice 360, which provides direct representation, but is also doing a lot of really important policy work focused on criminal justice, but also focused on root causes. Then there's the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Durham, North Carolina. And they do, again, both direct representation and have a really robust policy division that has been doing some really important reporting on the intersection of both poverty and race in the criminal justice and the administration of the death penalty specifically, but also criminal justice in North Carolina. We work, you know, when we are working on a case, a huge part of our work is to tell the story of our clients' lives. I'll get slightly wonky. So a capital trial everywhere will have two phases. There will be the guilt-innocence phase, where the question is, you know, did the defendant commit the crime charged? And then if convicted, there is a penalty phase where the jury has the decision of whether to impose a sentence of death or a sentence of life or life without parole. And, you know, what the availability of the lesser sentence depends on the jurisdiction. But they are allowed to consider during that phase any evidence, or no limits allowed, that is offered in mitigation of that sentence. So anything offered to say, you know, this is this client, again, not the worst of the worst. There are circumstances that you have to know before assessing the client's culpability. And that can range from, you know, whether the client has an intellectual disability, the age of the client, childhood trauma. The Supreme Court has recognized some categories as just per se mitigating, and those are among them. And then, and in that phase, you know, where everything sort of can be presented, we try to tell our clients' stories, their histories. We try to actually compile and present social histories. The social workers in the crowd are reacting to the jury so that they can understand what led the client to a crime that might seem at first blush inexplicable. And so we work in compiling those histories with everyone. We'll work with the client's family, the client's neighbors, the client's teachers, the client's faith community. And we've often, I mean, I will say personally, I've often found the faith communities in, you know, especially in the particularly impoverished areas of the Southeast where we're often working, to be both the most reliable reporters of, and you know, folks who have attempted to assist with, you know, some of these traumas that we're trying to document and present to the jury. Sorry, that was the long answer.
Oh, no, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I mean, this sounds like incredibly challenging work. You know, I'm thinking of, I'm sure some of the folks on the call are thinking of going into, you know, the legal profession. And thinking about some of the folks, and you know, I'll let you, the all of them ask their questions in just a minute. Maybe this will be
sure.
My last question. So the rest of you, please get ready to jump right in. But I'm curious of, you know, so you've interacted with lots of folks doing this work by now. What are some of the you know, maybe some traits that you've seen and folks that have been really helped them be successful in doing this work. Maybe some traits that have made other folks have challenges in really doing this well. What have you seen?
The work is changing in a couple of important ways. I think everybody's been following what's been happening in the Supreme Court over the last few weeks. And, you know, there have been a number of decisions sort of specific to my area of practice, which have been, you know, I think injurious decisions, it's fair to say. But there is a perception for a long time. I'll give you an example. I was listening to the audiobook of Devil in the Grove by Gilbert King, which is a terrific book. I recommend it, about Thurgood Marshall's representation of the Groveland Boys in Florida. And these are four men who were accused falsely of raping a teenaged white girl in Groveland, Florida. And no, wait, Bay Lake. I'm not going to get it right. I apologize. One of whom was lynched prior to the criminal trials. But Thurgood Marshall is talking, you know, they're talking about Marshall's legal strategizing. And they quote him as saying, you know, what I want to do is get to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is where I have a level playing field. And that was the ideal that shaped a whole lot of legal practice. The idea that, you know, the way that you affect change and the way that you protect the rights of all citizens and your clients is in the courts. That's sort of the refuge. And I think that that idea is profoundly challenged now. And if that's your idea of representation, then it's going to be quite incomplete. I was reading a thread, if I can find it, I will share it, from a professor of democracy at Harvard this morning, who was saying that, you know, at this point, this now half century old notion that you go to the courts, 70 year old notion that you go to the courts for relief and justice. Now we have to look back and say, like, which courts are we going to? Maybe we're going to the state courts. And maybe we are organizing to make sure that the state courts are better representing the will of the people, you know, the positions that the majority of people actually hold. And maybe we are organizing within communities and pushing for some kind of change. That relates to your question in that I think a huge part of this work, the people I've seen who are very successful in this work are very client focused. You know, we have specific jobs. We are not issue advocates. We represent clients. You represent a specific person, and that client's interests have to be paramount. But you also are looking to tell bigger and broader stories. And that involves being creative, thinking outside of this sort of traditional procession of, like, I'm going to go to federal court and file the 1983 raising these violations. And as long as I argue it effectively, I'm going to prevail. That's not how it works anymore. I really feel at this point you have to change the story. And the folks that I see who are doing, like, the most remarkable work are changing the story. That's Brian Stevenson down at EJI. That's the Center for Death Penalty Litigation and litigation related to the Racial Justice Act. I mean, what, you know, first, just the effort of having the Racial Justice Act in North Carolina passed, which, for those who you don't know, it was a statute that short-lived and then repealed, but that allowed prisoners, you know, under sentences of death to go back into court and present evidence of racial discrimination at every phase of the proceedings against them, in the decision to seek the death penalty, in the decision to impose the death penalty, in the selections of jurors. That's the kind of work that's changing the story. And I think that's the kind of work that we're all going to have to commit to and figure out ways to commit to in the years ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll have a few brave individuals who are willing to maybe turn their camera on and jump right in. Yeah, Kate. I see Kate Goodman. Come on in.
Hi, my name is Kate. This summer I'm in Brunswick, Georgia, working for SHEP. And I don't know if you know anything about Brunswick, if you've lived in Atlanta, but I wish I'd counted so far the number of times our attorneys have said, well, if this were in Atlanta, that argument would work, but we're in Brunswick, so we can't make that.
Yep.
And I guess I wanted to see if you see those, I guess, cultural divides differences coming up at the appellate level and with capital cases. And then second part, like, do you think that that is constitutional if you're talking about a right to a fair trial and a Brunswick jury would be completely different than one in Atlanta, maybe?
Yeah. Great question. And that the premise of the question is absolutely right. And I'll go a little bit further. So the whole idea, so when the Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional in Furman v. Georgia, the issue was the arbitrariness of the punishment, that there was no logic in who got the sentence and who did not. They eventually, you know, reauthorized the death penalty with provisions that were supposed to prevent that kind of lightning strike aspect of a death sentence. But the arbitrariness persists. And one of the key areas of arbitrariness is geography. And so when your attorneys say, like, this argument would fly in Atlanta, I don't know if they're talking about a jury argument or a judge argument. It is true, though, that if you look at the number of folks who are on death row in Georgia, there are very specific counties that have a disproportionate number of death sentence prisoners coming from their court system. It is rare to have a death sentence come from DeKalb County. It is rare to have a death sentence come from Fulton County. It is now slightly less, it's considerably less likely to have one from Cobb County, although Cobb used to be a pipeline. So, and if you look at states across the country, there will be these specific areas where death sentences are, that make up a huge percentage of the number of death sentences imposed in a state. It'll be a specific county. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Was not in my turf in Georgia. I'm not going to pretend to know exactly what's going on there. But a lot of times what you find is prosecution. You know, the people making the decision which cases to prosecute capitally and how successful those prosecutors are in selecting a jury that is going to impose the sentence that they're seeking or the harshest sentence available. So outside of that, I mean, arguments that you make, you know, the idea that an argument will fly in some point, again, some places and not in others, they are absolutely right to identify that the person receiving the argument is going to determine its effectiveness a lot more than the person delivering it. And whether that's a jury or a judge, you are going to see a wide variety. The sad thing, I'll just mention real quick about most state court elections, is that they aren't challenged. You know, there are a lot of judges at the trial level and in the state trial courts and the state appellate courts who essentially run unopposed. And the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, has been very aggressive with the appellate courts and with the superior courts and persuading people to retire or step down from the bench at a point that it would allow him to appoint their replacement and stave off an election. So those are all some of the trends that might explain that very correct statement that the lawyers you're working with are making. Did that even remotely answer your question?
Yeah, it did.
Oh, good. All right.
Quick follow-up, not to take anyone else. Do you think it would be more meaningful or do better, more good, if those of us on this call that are interested in doing law became prosecutors or defense attorneys?
It is, I have a lot of friends who are, you know, part of this progressive prosecutor movement. And I have a lot of friends who would tell you that progressive prosecution is an oxymoron. I am more in the former camp. I think that these are public offices that are going to be filled, and knowing how much discretion prosecutors have in deciding whether to prosecute a case capitally, whether to, what charges to seek, what cases to pursue, just across the board, I would rather have folks there who do not have a perhaps overly punitive sensibility. Having said that, it's really hard if you are not sort of dispositionally suited to prosecution to prosecute. It's really hard, and it can be, you know, it can be corrosive. I have friends who have left the profession, you know, who went in with very much that idea of like, I'm gonna do it, but I'm gonna do it the right way. And, you know, some of them ended up just being pretty beat up by the experience. I knew someone when I was working in Alabama who had worked in the Capital Unit of the Attorney General's office. We had a mutual friend, so I'd met her when she first moved down. She was clerking on like the Court of Appeals. And then she went and worked for, you know, kind of our opposite number. And I remember the first time there was an execution in Alabama during that period, I suddenly had a knock on my door like the following morning, and I opened it up and she was standing in the doorway just in tears. So, you know, if you do go into prosecution, I think you have to, this is an extreme example, obviously, but I mean, if you do go into prosecution, I think you have to accept that, you know, you are going to be sending people to jail, at least some people. And is that something that you can get to? And I just flag it because not everybody can, but anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
Yeah, two good questions.
Yeah. Any others with questions? Kate set a high bar, but there we go, Leah. Great. Thank you.
Well, I'll let Leah go.
Okay.
You're come good. Hi, I'm Leah. Hey. I work with Kate in the public defender's office. I'm in Brunswick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's five of us, so we're all here.
Oh, good for y'all. Holy cow.
My question kind of goes off Kate's follow-up a little bit. I feel like we've been having a lot of conversations with attorneys and people we're meeting about kind of why to become a public defender versus any other kind of law, and sure, how like much like ethics and morals play into wanting that specific role versus like getting a job kind of thing. So I think we've had a lot of discussion around, I'd love to get your thoughts on, like what that is like taking different roles within the criminal justice system, and if there's some that are more noble, more effective, more whatever it is in any situation.
Sure. No, it's a tricky question. And I mean, I think developing a sort of a moral hierarchy for work is problematic. And candidly, you'll be in a professional community that's very anxious to do that. If you go into any profession where you occasionally feel like you are dealing with just implacable adversaries and odds, you know, you will be tempted to lash out at the people you work with, or the people with whom you're ostensibly allied, because they're actually the people you can reach. Like, they're the people you can hurt. So it's an impulse that pops up again and again. I don't know if you've observed it, but I mean, I think in terms of the hierarchy of the work, I don't really subscribe to it. I think the one thing I would say is, I think do the job on its own terms. I mean, like if you are a public defender, you are representing a series of clients. Your obligation is to a specific client, to the idiosyncrasies of that case, to the specifics of the facts, and to what best serves the client. We often see tensions between that kind of direct representation and more of an impact litigation model, where a lot of times you're trying to find the case that has the facts that best advances, you know, the issue that you are, you know, hoping to advance. And that's fine. That's, you know, there's a pretty fantastic and meaningful tradition of work in that area. It is not entirely compatible with public defense. I mean, you might have a client who has, you know, say you have a client where the prosecution has committed a, you know, an obvious Brady violation, and you're going to whack them, and this is great, and you think this is going to be an issue that you can use to show pervasive corruption in this prosecution's office, and you can already see like the nightly news bulletin on it, and then they offer your client a deal, and it's a good deal. You know, your advocacy for the issue, you want the client to turn it down and stay in the case. If you're advocating for the client, it's a very different calculus. So, I mean, I get, that's what I would say, is just because there are a lot of different ways to do work in the legal context and not, that is in keeping with your desire for how the world should be and that moves the world hopefully towards that. But just do the job on its own terms. If you're a public defender, you know, you're not an impact litigator. And if you're a public defender, you're not an aspiring talking head. You know, you got to be really careful what you're putting on Facebook, because then, you know, some judge is going to see. If you're an impact litigator, you're almost obliged to use Facebook. It's that kind of thing. So I think you've got to just be really clear on who and what you represent. Because if there's one thing about law that is, you know, it is at least theory, this idea of self-abnegation. I mean, your interests must be subservient to what's in the client's best interest. And, you know, if the client is an issue, it's a different analysis than if the client's a person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, sure. That felt more babbly than usual, even.
Abby, do you still have, was it Abby? Am I right?
Hey. Yes, it was me.
Hey, Abby.
Hello. Hello, Bo. Similar to like Leah and Kate, I also have a question kind of pertaining to like, you know, moral ethics in the court and how that appears. This summer I'm working in like a domestic violence center. So my work isn't specific to like legal representation, but oftentimes I've been going to court just to like add emotional support to people that are trying to get like protective orders, where it's like basically in the hands of the judge. Yeah. And related to like personal beliefs, and I'm in Roanoke, Virginia also, so it's like, you know, on the cusp of being like more rural, but you know, still pretty urban in many aspects. But I was curious to see also in just like the grand scheme of things and trends in the court, just how you see personal beliefs like interfering with just like correct legal practice from like the judge's perspective. Mostly, I feel like that's a hot topic, especially right now.
Yeah.
Just how personal beliefs are showing. And
yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a really challenging time for, in some ways, like the entire idea of law. I don't know. You know what the legitimacy of courts depends upon the idea that there will be, you know, impartial justice meted out. And we all know that that is a dicey proposition, even when everyone is scrupulously trying to adhere to it. I mean, we're all motivated actors. We all engage in motivated reasoning. We all have our blind spots and biases and predilections. I mean, it's a given. Having practiced for a long time, I have no ideals left about how decisions are reached. I think that's a good thing. I mean, you just recognize that like human actors are involved kind of all along the way, but I think that what I take from it is that it is more important to get the story right than the argument. And that has always been true, but you've been able to convince yourself that it wasn't as important. You know, this idea that you could just go into court and just have the best argument and win, I really think at this point you have to have the best story. That's probably always been true. It's just really starkly, obviously true now. So I think, you know, when we are going into court, we have to assume that the court is going to respond better to a presentation that maybe changes the way they think about a specific client, as opposed to a way that, you know, identifies the controlling authority, cites analogous cases, you know, includes rhetorical flourishes. Like, I think that stuff has probably never been the most important part, and now it's definitely not the most important part. So I still feel like it's been a really, you know, it's been a challenging few weeks, but I still feel like there are absolutely judges in every court, in every state, every level, who are, you know, desperately trying to get to the right answer. And if you show them, you know, why this is the right answer, they'll go your way. They'll go your client's way. But, you know, so I'm not saying that anything is more broken necessarily than it always has been. But, you know, we've got to rise to the challenge of telling better and more complete stories on behalf of our clients, or on behalf of, you know, what we're hoping to advance. And, you know, and some of that involves, you know, trying to persuade more people of that than just a judge or a panel of judges or nine judges. It's turning a community around, turning legislators around. I think that's going to be sort of the work going forward. Was that even remotely responsive? I swear to God,
it got me thinking about other things in the process and, like, you know, seeing maybe where I might have been limited. So it was still helpful.
I'm glad I answered a question roughly adjacent to the one you asked. Oh, yes. Lord. Sorry about that.
No, you're so good. That was still, like, great. Thank you, Beau.
Okay. I'm getting graded generously here.
Well, you know, we're on a curve here in the summer. It looks like Shayla has a question. Maybe this will be the last one. Maybe I've got a closing question at the end, but we go there. Go ahead and turn your camera on if you'd like, or go ahead and just speak. You don't have to turn your camera on if you prefer. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I'm not going into law. I'm not looking into that, but I am a peace studies major.
Okay.
And so I deal a lot with, like, we did a deep intensive study of Stacey Abrams' campaign and wrote her book. For a midterm course. And I also just spend a lot of time talking about some really difficult and really heartbreaking issues. I'm doing my internship in DC this summer. So everything happening this summer is feeling really intimate, personal, and doing a lot of going out there and trying to do something about it. But one thing that I constantly struggle with is maintaining hope. So when things go wrong, it can be so frustrating that it's almost debilitating. I guess my question is, like, in both the general world, but most specifically, like, your practice, when things don't work out, when people do end up being executed, like, how do you deal with that?
Executions are heartbreaking. I've had a number of clients executed. I've witnessed three executions of clients of mine, or I felt like you never feel like you've done all that you could do. It is very difficult. But I have exactly the resource that you need, which is, and I'll find it, but you can also just sort of Google it, which is an answer that Brian Stevenson I work with gave in exchange with a student at the University of Chicago, some event David Axelrod, I think, was doing. And it was a young man who had grown up in an extremely violent environment. He was struggling to kind of retain hope. And, you know, Brian's answer was, like, you give me hope, but also I draw hope from the people who have come before us. I draw hope from people who had to maintain hope and maintained hope in circumstances far worse than these. And he talked about knowing John Lewis. And he's like, you know, I've never actually had my skull broken open by police officers. He's like, I've dealt with racism. I've dealt with discrimination. I've dealt with incredibly discouraging circumstances. But when he looked back at the folks who had come before him and some of the circumstances in which they had to find and maintain hope, he found the strength, if nothing else, because it would feel almost unpardonable to abandon hope when folks found it and maintained it under far direr circumstances. And I think that is true. And so I think, you know, a study of history can help us find those. Rebecca Traister had an essay over the weekend about this stuff that was very useful along the same lines of just, you know, like, look back, you know, at the moments of real darkness in our history and look at the people who turned the tide and look at how hard it must have been for them to find hope and maintain hope. So, I mean, there are inspirations everywhere. you know, their inspirations. I mean, I this is going to sound incredibly hackneyed, but I mean, this group is inspirational to me. You know, and I have a friend the other day who was joking that he'd be like, if you don't have one mentor who's at least 20 years younger than you, you're not doing it right. But I mean, I really look to some of the folks I work with who are earlier in their careers, who are on fire and much more creative and inventive than I think I ever was, and much less tolerant of nonsense than I have been. So there are inspirations everywhere. There are sources of hope everywhere. Not hoping is just it's not an option. We don't want to live in a world where we've decided hope is lost forever, and it would disrespect the world before, you know, and all the changes that people wrought to that world to abandon it. So, yeah. But yes, Google, Brian Stevenson, Chicago, Axelrod, hope, and you'll get the clip. And Brian is, I mean, if in all seriousness, if you were ever just looking for a hope fix, just Google Brian Stevenson and just listen to Brian. Brian, he's exactly as he seems. God bless him.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you, Shayla. You actually got it, the exact question I was going to get at.
Oh.
I think, and with that,
sorry about that.
Yeah, I just really want to thank, Bo, thank you for joining us this evening.
Sure.
Certainly want to thank Abby, Kate, Shayla, and Leah for their questions. They were great. Thank everyone else, you know, for joining us. I'll put in a plug that you can join us tomorrow evening, same time, 7 o'clock Eastern, to hear from Suki Tabor from the New York Youth Bureau with the City of Ithaca. You can find the registration link on shepherdconsortium.org. Anyway, thanks to you, Bo. Thanks to everyone for joining us. And hope you all have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are interested in watching any of the practitioner talks from the summer, check out SHEP's website or YouTube channel. Until next time, this is SHEP Talks. Mm-hmm.